nurse practitioner with Group Health Cooperative in Seattle. I'm specialized in OBGYN, and my topic tonight is medical menopause, what we think we know. And the reason for that title is because there's a lot of controversy about menopause, and there's a lot of controversy about the research that's been done about menopause. And so what I'm going to do tonight, because I think it's important if we're going to discuss the whole issue of menopause, is to try and give you sort of the standard medical approach to menopause right now. The kind of thing you would probably get if you went to your doctor's office or your nurse practitioner's office to discuss menopause. And I think then what we're going to try, I'm going to try and get into more tomorrow night, is some more of the controversies surrounding this, and maybe look at it through a slightly more critical feminist perspective, and you know, try to address some of the questions that a lot of people have brought up about the current therapies and the current way that menopause is dealt with. But I think it is important to understand sort of where the medical community is coming at it before we start critiquing how the medical community is coming at it. So that's kind of what I'm doing here. Oh, and the other thing I wanted to say about Thursday is some people feel more comfortable with having their doctor give them information, and that's sort of all they want to know. And it gets to be too confusing and overwhelming, and I think there's a lot of medical information out there, and it's real easy to get overwhelmed by controversies and conflicts in how we deal with that information. So if you're someone who would feel more comfortable with basically what the doctors are saying these days, that's what you're going to get tonight. And if you are uncomfortable with controversy and sort of don't want to cloud your perspective of what your doctor's been telling you, you may not want to come on Thursday, because it will probably be more conflicting information. And I know that a lot of people are uncomfortable with that, so just to let you know how that's going to work out. If people do have comments that they want to discuss tonight, I welcome you to bring those up, and I'd be happy to discuss them. If they seem like they'll fit better in that discussion on Thursday, I might ask you to just jot them down so you can bring those questions back for Thursday. And just to tell you a little bit about myself, as I said, I'm a women's health nurse practitioner. Nurse practitioners are people who go on from, I have training as a Bachelor of Science in Nursing, and then I went on and did specialized training to become an OBGYN nurse practitioner. I see mostly what we call well women who are coming in for their annual exams, young women who want birth control information, who have sexually transmitted disease questions, or just coming in for their regular pap and pelvic, older women who have questions about menopause, and then I also help women manage medications for their menopause, and see older women for their annual exams whether they're taking medication or not. Go ahead.
Can you talk a little slower?
I'm sorry. Okay. I tend to talk fast, so you might have to remind me to do that again. It's what happens when my adrenaline starts going. The reason that, one of the reasons I'm interested in women's healthcare, besides being a woman and wanting to be healthy myself, is that I see women's healthcare issues closely tied to how women view themselves and where our self-esteem and self-worth and self-image come from. And I think that the more we know about our bodies, the more comfortable we are with them, and the more we are able to be what I would call a whole person in the society. The more we know about ourselves, I think the less biology becomes destiny, and we can make some of our own choices about what we do with our biology and what we do with medicine and those issues. I see my role both in my practice and here as a facilitator, to try and facilitate women's quest for the kind of understanding that will empower them to make their own choices about their health care. And I also see myself as a translator interpreter. I try to translate sort of medical jargon into normal person-ese. And so that's one of the things I'll try and do. I can't always do that in my practice, so it's nice to have this setting, because most people, there's not enough time. I mean, I can barely give them the basic medical information, let alone try and translate that into more normal person-ese. So it's kind of fun to be able to be here and do some of that. I'm going to start out with a little bit of a warning about the backdrop to this talk, and that's that right now medicine basically treats menopause as a disease, and that's not really my perspective, but when I give you the spiel, it's going to sound like it's my perspective, so I just want to warn you about that. There has been a movement away from that, and I think a lot of physicians and nurse practitioners and other people are coming to the understanding that menopause is not a disease, it's part of the natural aging process. But the way we still deal with it in a medical setting is, we look at people's symptoms, and we treat them with a medicine to treat their disease. And it's not so much that we're treating menopause, but we're treating the fact that women after menopause no longer have the same levels of estrogen in their body. So the disease that we're treating, at least in the medical framework, is estrogen deprivation. So you no longer have the same kind of estrogen levels you had when you were in your childbearing years, therefore we will now treat you with estrogen so that you will continue to have those levels of estrogen. So and that's what I mean when I'm talking about they treat it as a disease. And you're going to wonder where I stand on all of this, and I wonder about it myself sometimes. I have been definitely, I would say, seduced by powerfully convincing bright women physicians who I trust and respect and like as friends, who are very, very forceful and articulate evangelists for hormone replacement therapy. I mean, they are very convinced that this is the way we definitely need to be going. And I feel very strongly, and I give that information to most of my patients. The kind of information I'm going to talk about on Thursday is all the reasons why I feel uncomfortable with that. But tonight I'll talk about all the reasons I do feel comfortable with giving hormones. But I think there are a lot of good reasons on both sides. So I'm going to start out talking a little bit about the anatomy and physiology of menopause. I mean, basically what's happening. And show you up here a little bit. Throughout all the years that you were having menstrual periods, well, let's just start when you were born. Actually, you were born with between 100,000 and 400,000 what we call oocytes, or baby little ovums in your ovaries that were going to turn into eggs eventually, but they weren't quite there. As you aged, before you even got to the age of puberty, you'd lost a good portion of that. And what happens to the rest of your life cycle is you're gradually losing all of those little oocytes, so those little sort of precursor eggs in the ovary. And so that when you get to the age of menopause, basically all of those oocytes are gone. There may be a few left, but they are really resistant to any kind of hormonal stimulation. So this is the kind of hormonal stimulation that happens here. We start out with the hypothalamus, which is part of your brain, and it releases a hormone which signals another part of your brain, the anterior pituitary, to release these two hormones. Now, it's not important that you know these names at all, but just to give you an idea of what's going on with this cycle. These two hormones send messages to your ovaries, and in your ovaries are the oocytes, or the little baby ovums, I guess you could call them. And what they do is basically tell them to start maturing. And they send this message down. Usually there's one oocyte that starts maturing. And in that process, as it matures, it starts sending out estrogen and progesterone. And those are the two hormones that we think of when we think of female hormones. Those are the two hormones we give people for hormone replacement therapy, is estrogen and progesterone. So as this egg is developing in your monthly cycle, a couple of different things are happening. One, the lining of your uterus, which is a poor drawing here, but the lining of your uterus is getting thicker. And what it's doing there is trying to get itself ready to receive a fertilized egg. And as that lining gets thicker and thicker, the ovary is still putting out more and more, especially estrogen in the beginning. That level of estrogen, a message is being sent back up to all this business in the brain saying, we have high levels of estrogen, please turn off the FSH and LH. So these are turned off during this period of time. What happens is we eventually get to the point where the ovary is ready to spit out that egg that it's been maturing. And when it does that, at the time of ovulation, it gets spit out, goes down the fallopian tubes, makes its way down here. If it doesn't get fertilized, it leaves the body. And the other thing that happens in the ovary, as it's been maturing an egg, this is maybe your ovary here. This little sac has been maturing an egg right in here. When the egg gets released, this sac stays there, and what it does is it produces progesterone, the other hormone that's in your cycle. So now you have a certain high level of estrogen, you're now getting a higher level of progesterone. What progesterone does is hold this lining in place. It's been developing in response to estrogen. The progesterone holds the lining in place until it receives the message that no pregnancy's occurred. Then the progesterone basically drops way down, the estrogen drops way down, and that's when you lose the lining of your uterus and you have a menstrual period. So that's what's been happening all the years you've been having periods. What happens with, what happens after menopause is that this part is still all functioning. And what it's doing is it's sending this FSH and LH message in larger amounts to the ovary saying, please start making an egg. I'm not getting a message here that you're making estrogen and progesterone, so please start making an egg so that I can turn off. Well, nothing happens because either the eggs that are there are no longer responsive to hormones. They may have been sitting around in your body your whole life, not responding to hormones, which is why they're still there. Or they just simply are gone, and so there's nothing to respond. So what happens is the estrogen and progesterone levels fall, and that causes a lot of the symptoms that we see in menopause. The FSH and LH levels rise and get very high. It's one of the blood tests that we do to see whether or not you're menopausal. We check and see what your FSH and LH level is. If it's very high, that gives us a pretty good indication that you're in menopause. What happens then with the estrogen and progesterone, occasionally, one of the eggs will start developing a little bit. It'll spit out enough estrogen so you may develop a lining to your uterus, but it may never actually release that egg. So you don't have the extra progesterone there to hold that lining in place. Consequently, you can get some spotting, irregular spotting, or you can just get very heavy, very long periods because the estrogen keeps building this lining, but there's nothing there to keep it in place, and there's nothing there to stop that growth. It just gets thicker and thicker and then kind of falls off and falls off and falls off and falls off and causes a lot of heavy bleeding. So that's kind of the basic biology of all of this. Any questions about that?
How does what you're describing differ from endometriosis?
Endometriosis is a condition where the lining of the uterus, the endometrium, which is right here, for reasons that we're not entirely sure of, cells that line the uterus manage to make their way back out through the fallopian tubes and end up various places inside your belly. And those cells attach, like to the side of your ovary, to the side of your fallopian tube, to the side of your uterus, to the side of your vagina, to the side of your intestine, or the side of your kidneys or your bladder. And when that happens, the same thing that happens under hormonal stimulation to the lining of your uterus will happen to those cells, which are now outside of your uterus. And so you get these small areas where you build up a lining, it tries to bleed, there's no place for that blood to go, and you build scar tissue in those areas. And that's why people have a lot of pain with endometriosis, is because you've got these different pinpoints of scar tissue all over your belly.
So what is the treatment of choice for?
The treatment for endometriosis, it varies widely depending on your age, your desire, if you're still in your premenopausal years and you desire to have children. They can give you birth control pills to try and slow down the growth of the endometrium here as well as on the outside. Mm-hmm. But they can also, the only way we can really diagnose it is to do surgery and look inside to see if we can see those implants of endometrial tissue. And then they can be burned off with electric cautery or with laser. That's the only real treatment for the disease. But a large number of women have a small amount of endometriosis. It maybe doesn't cause most people much pain, but when they've done studies, and don't ask me who volunteered for these studies, where women said that it's okay, fine, go ahead and look around in there and see what you can find, they found it in about 70% of all women. And a lot of those women had no symptoms and no problems with it. So it's probably not as much a disease process as it is a normal process that in some people just causes a lot more problems than in others.
Is there any connection between the age of the beginning of the menstrual period and the beginning of menopause?
Not necessarily. Some people think that the earlier you have a period, the earlier you're going to have menopause, but that doesn't always follow. It seems almost to follow more closely on when your mom was menopausal, though that's not a direct correlation either. And then a lot of women, their moms have had surgical menopause. They've had hysterectomies, so there's no way for them to know, you know, when your mom would have been, would have had menopause.
Well, I've heard the other way, that if you had an early menstrual cycle as a younger than normal, that mm-hmm. you actually might have.
You might, but it's not necessarily statistically significant. I mean, it can be either way. You can start having periods late and start having menopause very early. And that happens as well. Go ahead.
I'm getting a little confused because when mm-hmm. I hear you talk about menopause, I'm hearing you talk about different things that mm-hmm. sound like different meanings. Can you kind of define what the menopause process is?
And one of the reasons that it's confusing is, and I'll get into this more tomorrow, no one has actually studied natural menopause. No one has come up with a definitive diagnosis for all the terms that we use in menopause. Everyone uses those terms slightly differently. And that's one of the problems when we talk about menopause at all. Basically, what we mean by the word menopause is the time when you stop having periods. So the last period, after that point, you're in menopause. Okay? And before that time period, there's a long period where you've got a lot of hormonal fluctuation. What I mostly described here is a normal menstrual cycle. And then talked about what would happen when the ovaries no longer have those little oocytes to respond to all this hormonal information. And so that period of time when you're still getting a lot of FSH stimulation and occasionally you're producing something and occasionally you're not and you're having irregular periods, we call that the perimenopausal period. And that's a relatively new term that we've just been using, I'd say, in the last, I don't know, 10 or 15 years. But the perimenopausal period can describe a wide, long period of time. For some women, the perimenopausal period can be 10 years. For some women, it can be 1 year. When you're going through a number of hormonal variations, you're still having occasional periods. You may be having pretty regular periods, but you notice that they're changing quite a bit. Or you may be having some of the other symptoms that we associate with menopause during that time, but you're still having periods. And so we count all of that time as the perimenopausal period.
So is menopause then, you were talking about a blood test earlier, is it defined basically now more by a blood test or
no.
a certain period of time after one's last period?
It's like defined by a certain period after your last period. Sometimes when people come in with a number of symptoms and we're trying to help them figure out what's going on, we may do a blood test just to see what's happening with their hormone levels. That's not always done, and a lot of doctors don't even like doing it because they don't feel that it always gives very helpful information. Your FSH and LH levels rise and fall through every cycle that you have. Mm-hmm. What we see after menopause is that they tend to stay very elevated for a long period of time, like the rest of your life, basically. But it's possible when we test you for your FSH and LH level that we could get a high reading, which we could interpret as menopause, which could really just be, you know, at a low point in your estrogen and progesterone production, and you're going to come cycling back through this. So some doctors don't feel it's a very helpful test at all. And we look more, for example, at how long you are from your last period. And in terms of hormone replacement therapy, when I get to discuss that, that we don't like to give to people until they've been a year away from having their last menstrual period. And I'll describe some of the reasons for that.
I'm just going to explain what causes hot flashes.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to try to. That's one of the things that actually we don't know. But I will tell you what we don't know about what we don't know, if that makes any sense. But I will talk about that next.
More importantly, you're going to tell us what to do about it.
Yep, I'm going to give you some information about that as well. As I said, some of the things that you'll notice as you approach menopause is this irregular cycle. Some women have longer cycles, some women have shorter cycles. And this can mean one of two different things. You can have longer time period between each cycle, or your actual flow can be longer or shorter, can be lighter, can be heavier. There can be almost any variation you can imagine.
Can you have these variations? At different times?
Mm-hmm. And, you know, the difficult thing, and it's difficult for us as practitioners as well, there are some irregularities in your period that signal to us that something wrong is going on. But there are other things that we can kind of basically say that it's probably due to menopause. We may want to do a couple of tests to be sure that that's all that's going on. But it is a confusing time. It's a confusing time for women because they have a lot of symptoms. As long as you're still having periods, it's hard to treat you, at least, you know, in the medical model by using hormone replacement therapy. So the perimenopausal period has not, one, been studied very much, and two, the medications that we have for menopause, we don't feel real comfortable giving those during perimenopausal period. So it's a difficult period of time for women and also for practitioners to know how best to handle people going through that.
Are the medications you're talking about going?
Right, exactly. The hormones of estrogen and progesterone, right, and I'll get to that soon. Okay. Any other questions?
What age?
Median age of menopause in the United States is 51, but we don't consider people to be having what we would call premature menopause, i.e. menopause for some reason that we can't quite understand. As long as their periods, it's, let's 40 to 60 are sort of, that's the normal ends of the range. You know, if you're menopausal before the age of 40, usually they try and look at, you know, what's caused this, that they think there might be some other cause there that's going on, that maybe something could be corrected. But there are cases definitely where people maybe are born with a less number of eggs, or for some reason have used them up more quickly than other people, have maybe been exposed to some sort of toxic chemical that caused, you know, the eggs to be used up more quickly. There are lots of different reasons and speculations on why that would be. Despite the fact that the median age for menopause is 51, I have to say that in my practice I see a lot of women in their early 40s who are menopausal or experiencing changes with their periods.
I'm one of those people who for the last year has been in perimenopause, really, obviously. And really obviously.
I shouldn't laugh.
No, you know what I mean, right? And I also had my first and only child when I was almost 35. And I know several women who are very young, quote unquote, for going through this phase. And we all had our children in our 30s. Is there...
You know, I know of no research about that, but I would not be at all surprised if someone isn't doing that research right now, because I have certainly seen that in my practice as well.
And it means if you have a child later, that you get your
first child.
Yeah, your first child later. Yeah. It seems that for some people that's enough of a sort of shock to the hormonal system that it may just sort of cut things off. But again, I can't speak about that very authoritatively. I've seen it in my practice, and I've seen it in my friends. But I don't know of research studies that have necessarily validated that at this point. So, why don't I go on and just explain a few more of the nuts and bolts here, and then we can ask some more questions. As I said, some of the things you may notice are these irregular cycles. Some women have very heavy bleeding. We're more concerned about heavy bleeding or frequent bleeding than we are no bleeding. No bleeding usually means menopause, unless you're actively a marathon runner, have gotten your weight below, say, 100 pounds, or are anorexic or bulimic. If you're not having periods and none of those other things are going on, we're probably not going to worry about you a great deal. But we are much more concerned if you're having heavy bleeding or bleeding in between your periods or a lot of constant spotting. The reason we worry about that is there is a type of cancer that can affect the endometrium or the lining of the uterus. And so usually if you're having very abnormal bleeding like that, doctors usually want to check you out with a biopsy or some way of removing some of these cells from your endometrium to be sure that there's no cancerous cells there. But once that's done, and they've kind of ruled out that you have cancer, they usually say, okay, here are some medications, we're going to try and treat this. And one of the medications that we use to treat it is the hormone progesterone. If you remember when I discussed how this works, progesterone causes you to hang on to the lining of your uterus, and when the progesterone is withdrawn or when you stop taking it, the lining comes out. So if you're having a lot of heavy bleeding or heavy spotting because you're getting a lot of estrogen stimulation but not enough progesterone stimulation, you'll have a lot of lining, it'll bleed a lot, but there's nothing to hold it in place. So the doctors will try and give you progesterone to hold that in place for a while. Then when you stop taking it, you should have a big period, sort of get rid of everything that's there, and then hopefully get back to a normal cycle. Or they may want you to take progesterone month after month for a period of time, again, to try and give your body a chance to hang on to some of that lining so you aren't constantly bleeding.
Is that why some of the birth control pills are a combination of estrogen and
Right, exactly. Most all the birth control pills are a combination of these two hormones in an effort to mimic that natural cycle that we talked about. And it's also why when we give people estrogen replacement therapy or hormone replacement therapy, we do it somewhat in the same way, again, to sort of try and mimic what was going on before.
Then is that the reason that if you have had a surgical menopause, they don't bother with the progesterone?
Right. I'll get to that in just a little bit, because there's a side effect of using just estrogen alone if you have your uterus. And we can talk about that in just a little bit. So as I said, the periods are the sort of hallmark symbol of people going through the perimenopausal period, but the other thing is the hot flashes and hot flushes. Now, I am not perimenopausal at this point in time, so I have not experienced hot flashes and hot flushes. I can give you the textbook definition. I'm sure most of you are much better, more knowledgeable about this than any textbook. So if there's one person here who would like to volunteer and share their experience, how would you describe a hot flash or a hot flush? Okay, we've got many experts.
Yes, well, I can remember I was working in an office and it was only the man who was my superior and me. And it was in the middle of winter. And all of a sudden, I feel just real hot, and I turn on the air conditioner, and he kind of come in and look. He's got a man, and oh, come on, get with it. But anyway, that would go on. It just, it's just like, just a heat just coming all the way through, and you just feel real hot, mm-hmm. and you want to get something to kind of cool you down. So I turn on the air conditioner, mm-hmm. and then, oh, this went on for, months, and then one day I was talking to a friend and said something, and he was close by, and I was mentioning about turning on the air conditioner, and why, and he said, oh, that's it, and I thought, yeah, how dumb can you be, but anyway, it's just like a heat comes over you, mm-hmm. and it lasts just a little bit, but enough that I would turn on the air conditioner and then turn it off again.
Yeah.
And I said, oh, here comes another one, and then it would be over. Mm-hmm. I would maybe last a minute or two. It's not a long mm-hmm. time.
Well, the research on it says that the average length of a hot flash is 3.31 minutes.
Well, that might be.
So, just to let you know, researchers think that they're more frequent between the hours of 6 and 9 p.m., though I think women who work during the day say that that's not true at all. They experience mm-hmm. them all day long at work. And they vary in their severity. For some women, they're very, very mild, and for other women, they're absolutely overwhelming. And they vary in how long they last during this menopausal period. They can last, the statistics on this are that 75% of all women experience hot flashes, that 80% of those people that have hot flashes for longer than 1 year, and 25 to 50% have hot flashes for longer than 5 years. Oh, no. So it varies widely. And go ahead.
Well, what I remember is the concentration killing of it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can remember going to the symphony and looking down at the stage and thinking, are any of those women having hot flashes? If so, how do they concentrate? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, that it is what was more of a mental
exactly.
thing to me, and feeling exhausted mm-hmm. and clammy afterwards. It wasn't so much the heat.
The heat itself.
It was
right.
the effect
right.
of it.
Another thing that people notice, and I imagine a lot of you have noticed that as well, is the hot flashes at night, or the night sweats, waking up just drenched in sweat. Again, I feel sort of stupid talking about these things because I haven't had them, so here I'm talking to a room full of people that have, but that's what we do in medicine, you know, we talk about things that have never happened to us. So.
You have to get up and change your gas.
Right, exactly. And some of the other things that we see in menopause, emotional changes that go along with things in menopause, there's a lot of question as to why women have the kind of emotional changes, loss of concentration, mood swings, depression, loss of interest in sex. All those things have been attributed to menopause, and there are about three different reasons we think that may happen. One may be due to just hormonal shifts that may change the way we're able to process things. Secondly, maybe from just plain old sleep deprivation. If people are waking up constantly sweating at night, they're not getting very good sleep, and we know there's a lot of sleep disturbances that go on in menopausal women. And the other reason that possibly can also... Here, I'm losing my track here. What was my third reason on here for that? Besides sleep deprivation, hormone changes, and...
Well, maybe I'm going to be adding your
Go on, please do. Please do.
One of the things that contributes to this is this whole stage of our lives
yep.
usually coincides with the time at which we are under greatest stress.
Exactly.
If we are caretakers, mm-hmm. we probably are at a point of either finishing off the job of raising mm-hmm. children or have just finished our children and are concerned about the empty nest syndrome.
Right, so-called. Exactly.
And on top of it may come real concerns as caregivers of our parents.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
We're caught from both ends.
Right, and you're exactly right, and I just found my notes, and that's exactly what it says. So.
Okay, that's my
I'm right. Yeah, I'm right because you're validating what I've got written down here. I mean, you're right. So. But also because it's also part of aging, and for a lot of people in this culture, that's also a difficult thing as well. And so it's emotional response to aging, and it's also because at this point, as in all points in our life, we have a lot of stress. But certainly at the point of menopause, a lot of women are going through a lot of family stressors. So that's another reason, and certainly not having enough sleep to cope with all that stuff also impacts on this.
Well.
So.
When I started having hot flashes, I would have a hot flash, but I wouldn't sweat.
Mm-hmm.
But now I'm starting to sweat with them.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that, I thought, oh, it's okay, you know, you're just warm.
Mm-hmm.
But now, it's like,
Sweat, right. And now, someone asked me, why do you have these? Well, we don't understand that. Part of it is because the temperature regulation part of our body is closely associated with the hypothalamus. So when we're having all these kind of hormonal irregularities already, it's probably throwing that off a little bit. But frankly, we don't understand it. We do know that giving people estrogen, giving people hormone replacement therapy, usually stops the hot flashes for the period of time that they take the hormone. When they stop taking the hormone, frequently women will experience that again.
Or if they don't get enough.
Or if they don't get enough, exactly.
If they aren't being replaced with a sufficient level of estrogen.
Correct.
And that's sometimes a very tricky thing to fine-tune.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. There are a couple of other therapies that have been suggested for hot flashes. There are women who cannot take hormone replacement therapy, specifically women who have had breast cancer and various kinds of uterine cancer. It's not recommended that they take hormone replacement therapy. There are a couple of given for hot flashes. They have a lot of other side effects, and a lot of physicians don't feel comfortable giving them for hot flashes. I'm not going to get into a lot of that discussion tonight. I do have a number of books, and I'm sorry that I didn't order any for the bookstore. The problem is there's so many books out there, and I couldn't really say which one was the best one, and I wasn't really sure which to order. The one that I think is best is a book called Menopause Naturally, and I didn't order it for the bookstore because it's coming out in a new edition in October, and so I wanted people, if they were going to buy this book, to get the latest edition and not what we could get right now. And I'll pass this one around. In this book, and also in this book, which is Susan Mark's Menopause Self-Help Book, if you have had PMS and any experience with that, she also has a book on PMS. Both of these books get a lot of sort of home remedies, vitamin therapies, diet, nutrition, exercise ideas to help control a lot of the symptoms of menopause. Both of these women are quite skeptical of hormone replacement therapy. I would say Susan Lark a lot more so than Sonia Greenwood, who wrote this book. But they're very helpful, especially during the period of time before physicians are very willing to prescribe hormones to treat some of the symptoms that people are having. If you're still having your periods, you'll be lucky to find someone who's going to give you hormones. I don't know if it's luck or unluck, but it's difficult to give women hormones while they're still having periods, and I'll get into that in just a minute, but I'll pass these books around. This is a book that actually my clinic just started passing out to people. And she is much, much, much more gung-ho on hormones than either one of these two women authors. So there's a wide perspective.
Are all of these addressing the subject of women who enter menopause naturally?
These are more entering women entering menopause naturally than surgically, though they do address that to some degree. She addresses it more. I'll pass those around. We also have a booklet at my office that we put out, that Group Health puts out, that also has a book list on the back. And so that's some other ideas. And they tell on these little reviews whether or not the people promote or don't promote the use of hormones. And another book from the Santa Fe Health Education Project in New Mexico, where they've done a lot of work with, I'd say they tend to be more gathering their information from their patients rather than looking at scientific studies and giving people information. They put out a monthly, or is it bi-monthly or bi-yearly, I'm not sure how often, newsletter. And in the back of all of these books, they also have addresses for different newsletters for different concerns, both for menopause and other health concerns that older women have. So I really encourage you to take a look at these. I'm happy to loan them out. I do want you to return them to me, because otherwise I'll be really sad. There is one good book in the bookstore on menopause, and that is Ourselves Getting Older. That's an excellent book and an excellent resource for many, many subjects besides menopause. They deal with a lot of questions about housing, about families, about relationships, about sexuality, about diet, about nutrition. I mean, you name it, they've dealt with it in that book. And I didn't order a lot of copies of that either, because it's a book that's about this fat and it's a giant catalog, and I couldn't see a lot of people wanting to drag that home from Holden Village. It's available at most bookstores. It costs about $20, and it's an excellent, excellent resource. And I really encourage people to read that book as well.
Mm-hmm. You were talking about symptoms, and before you leave the subject.
Yeah, I know. I'm sort of balancing all over the place in response to questions here.
One of the things that always accompanies the hot flashes I have is this incredible pounding of the heart.
Yeah.
I was talking to you earlier about actually having had EKGs.
Right, exactly.
Before we kind of figured out what was going on. Is that
That's very common. That's very common.
How is that?
Again, we're not sure what it is, other than we think it's some of the same. The thing about the hypothalamus and the anterior pituitary, they're not just glands that secrete hormones. They also respond to nervous system stimulation. And so you've got this close connection between your nervous system, which will do things like make your heart pound faster, mm-hmm. like an adrenaline rush mm-hmm. would do. Mm-hmm. And that's basically what's happening. You're triggering that other part of your nervous system right. when you have the same kind of triggering of your temperature dysregulation in a body here. So that's as far as we know. And again, these things have not been well studied, and we really don't completely understand what's happening. But heart palpitations are very common. In your experience, and I think in the experience of most people, if you see a physician that has any question at all about you being in menopause and you complain to them about a heart problem, you know, they're bound that they have right. to really investigate to be sure you're not having some kind of right. heart problem. And so, you know, we do...
Well, I was convinced I was having heart problems mm-hmm. myself. I mean, mm-hmm. it wasn't a criticism.
Yeah,
it was
exactly.
the most incredible experience I've ever been.
And it tends to follow very closely with the hot flush.
Right. And the hot flush. It yeah. wasn't just like I was under stress. I wake up yeah. and I'm asleep.
And I'd say that's exceedingly common. You know, I might do a better service to all you people to leave the room and let you all talk to each other about your experiences, because you know more about it than I do. So, but
you have a clinical background.
Right, and I think the other thing, and what I feel good about being able to do for people who come to see me, is they come to see me and say, I think I'm going crazy. Mm-hmm. You know, and I can say, no, you're not. Let me tell you about this. This is exactly what most women your age, or soon to be your age, or soon after your age, are going through. This is normal. And part of the thing is, we haven't been very good in this culture in talking about that with other people. People are, it's a real difficult thing to talk about this with other women.
Even your mother won't tell you.
Mm-hmm, exactly. And that's a little bit more some of the stuff I want to get into tomorrow, and on Thursday, and some of the feminist critiques and some of the research that especially nurses have been doing. Nursing research has really been focusing more on menopause, I have to say, in some ways more than medical research. And have come up with some interesting theories and ideas.
Does group health have a group where women, menopause women can...
They don't. And I've had a lot of women who have asked for that. I know that there are a couple of different groups through the community college system. There's an organization called CRONE in Seattle. It's spelled C-R-O-N-E. And they are certainly a much more radical feminist kind of orientated group. And I do not know exactly how they feel about hormones, for example, or what their perspective is on a lot of this stuff. But they do have classes and groups that meet out of North Seattle Community College. There's also a couple of women who do classes on menopause out of the community colleges that I think may come from a more standard medical perspective. And my guess is that women in those classes frequently form support groups out of those classes. They're not like long-term classes, they're like one or two sessions. And so that might be something you might want to look into. I think in the past group health did have some support group programs, but I do not know of any that are happening right now. Another good thing is, in the back of some of these books with some of the organizations that they list, I think they may or may not, I'm not sure, be able to help you maybe find other people in your area that are interested in that. But it's hard. And I've tried to sort of gather names, but frequently the women that I see are extremely busy and say, I'd love to have a support group, but I really don't have time for it. You know, and so I don't, you know, it's hard to facilitate that kind of thing from my end as well. But, you know, and I constantly tell my patients, well, if you get one together, let me know. I have a lot of people who want to come to be with your group. So,
is weight gain part of menopause?
Change in metabolism is definitely part of menopause. Your metabolism slows down, and so weight gain can be a factor. Yep, mm-hmm. for sure. And fluid retention. You know, most PMS symptoms that we think of, breast tenderness, bloating, fluid retention, all those things can be greatly exaggerated in menopause. And part of it is because you're really getting different hormone levels, both of the estrogen and progesterone and the FSH and LH. All those things that were involved in making up PMS before are there to sort of an exaggerated degree. So people tend to get the sort of exaggerated PMS. And that's when, if you've never had PMS before in your life, you may get it as you approach menopause.
And if you've had PMS, does it get much worse?
Sometimes it gets worse, and for some women it gets better. You know, PMS is a whole other huge topic, but the research on it seems to indicate that women don't have it their whole lives. They have it for periods of time in their lives, like 4 or 5 years at a time, then it may completely go away. They may never have it again, or they may have it recurringly in cycles of every few years. So, you know, that varies greatly from individual to individual.
So
So.
Exercise is a real good thing for PMS.
Yeah, exercise is one of the things that has been researched and found that that helps about as much as anything else that's available.
But it doesn't do a thing for hot flashes.
Doesn't do a thing for hot flashes. Some of the suggestions in those books are, you know, learn to know some of the things that are going to trigger your hot flashes. And for some people, they feel like, you know, breathing triggers their hot flashes. You know, that's not going to help. But there are some things that have been shown to trigger hot flashes, and that is when you're hot, you're more likely to have a hot flash. If you're in a hot room, you're more likely to have a hot flash. If you're drinking hot beverages, you're more likely to have a hot flash. If you're drinking alcoholic beverages, you're more likely to have a hot flash. And so they give some suggestions around that. They also have some vitamin therapies and some herbal therapies that they recommend. Just another thing to throw out, I think that a good place to go for some information during this period of time when, again, hormones may not be the most appropriate treatment is I frequently suggest that my patients see a naturopath or a homeopath. I do not feel like I'm educated to give people that kind of information, but I do feel that we in medicine right now don't have all the answers for this. And if someone can give you some herbal therapies or some vitamin therapies that I'm not familiar with, I think that that's certainly an avenue worth exploring if people are having a lot of problems with it.
Is this a part of group health?
No, group health doesn't have it. No, it's not. It's my own personal medical philosophy. And the other thing, you know, you also have to watch who you're seeing. I think in Seattle we're very lucky because we have a homeopathic medical college, a naturopathic medical college. And so, for one thing, we have a large number of naturopaths in town. We also have a naturopathic college that has their own clinic, and so they see people for a lower price than naturopaths frequently see them on their own, because it's quite costly, and most insurance doesn't cover it. And most insurance will not cover the kind of therapies that they recommend. They can be quite costly as well. So, you know, maybe I should just continue and talk a little bit about the hormone stuff, just so we can get a little framework here to continue the conversation. So let's see, we're talking about the symptoms. Let me tell you about a couple of other ones that you may have noticed, just again to help you recognize that this is all normal stuff, and that's vaginal dryness. Now, a lot of people don't see that right away in menopause. For a lot of women, that comes later. But the tissues that line the vagina, the inside of the vagina, and also the tissue that lines the inside of the urinary tract, all those tissues are kept more elastic, more flexible by estrogen. And as people lose estrogen, the amount of estrogen in their system goes down, those tissues become drier, much more tender and more fragile. And this can result in painful intercourse, more frequent sort of burning and itching in the vagina, more frequent urinary tract infections, more frequent vaginal infections. One of the recommendations in all of these books is to increase the amount of sexual activity you have. Now, that is obviously not an option for a lot of people, at least with a partner. But they suggest more masturbation. And the reason for that is that the more often that you lubricate and the more often there's more lubrication in your vagina, the more lubricated the vagina is going to stay. Without sexual activity, either with the partner or with masturbation, there is a lot more atrophy of the vagina. So that is the suggestion in those books, and that's another section you might want to take a look at if you look at those books. Then the emotional changes, we talked about some of those things, the palpitations. The other more serious medical consequences that we see after menopause, besides the things that we've talked about, which we consider more sort of the signs and symptoms of menopause, but the long-term effects of not having estrogen in your system, are problems for both your bones and your heart. And I'm sure most of you are aware of those, and I'm just going to talk about those briefly. With heart disease is a number one killer in the United States for both men and women. And I think women have been lulled into kind of a false sense of security that it's the men that get the heart attacks and the women don't have to worry about that. And that is not true. By the time women are 65, their rate of heart disease is exactly the same as men's. And the reason for that is that during our childbearing years, when we had all this estrogen flowing around, it helped maintain the elasticity of our vessels. The reason that it did that is because to accommodate the changes that our bodies go through during pregnancy and childbirth. You know, we increase our blood volume in our body, and I don't do prenatal teaching often enough to remember how much, but it's like at least double. We actually increase our blood volume that much. So our blood vessels have to be able to respond to those kind of changes. and also respond to changes in blood pressure that occur with that. So once that estrogen, the estrogen is there for a protective reason, and once we're no longer in childbearing years and the estrogen is gone, our vessels are no longer as elastic. They get sort of like men's vessels. And the other thing that happens is that estrogen seems to promote high levels of what we call HDL cholesterol, or the good cholesterol. You may have heard people talk about that, and I'll pass around a little blurb about HDL cholesterol here. And another thing about fat. HDL cholesterol, the HDL stands for high density lipoproteins. And basically what that means is it's cholesterol that's circulating in our body all the time, taking away bad cholesterol from our bloodstream and putting it in our liver, where the liver can either use it or get rid of it. And so we want high levels of HDL cholesterol. We do not want high levels of LDL cholesterol, which is the cholesterol that then picks up bad cholesterol from our liver and then deposits it all over our blood vessels, building up the kind of plaques in our veins and arteries. Estrogen keeps HDL levels high and keeps LDL levels low. When we start losing estrogen after menopause, the HDL levels start falling to be what men's are, and LDL levels starts rising to be what men's are, and that's what puts women at risk for heart attacks and strokes after the age of menopause. And so that is one of the big reasons why we're promoting the use of estrogen after menopause, because by giving people replacement estrogen, by giving them estrogen after menopause, we can keep those HDL levels high and the LDL levels low. There was a lot of controversy, there still is a lot of controversy about this. We don't exactly understand all the mechanisms of estrogen and related to our heart and vessels. There were a couple of very, very good studies that came out this last year in the New England Journal of Medicine, which documented that women who take hormone replacement therapy, though they were just looking at estrogen in this study, which makes it controversial, cut their rate of heart attack by 50% versus women who don't take hormone replacement therapy. So that is, you know, very convincing evidence, and there's a lot of other convincing evidence that it's good for your heart to be taking hormones. The other reason that we promote the use of hormones is for osteoporosis, and that's bone loss. A lot of you may be aware of this because of your mothers or your grandmothers. You've seen the dowager hump that women develop. What that is from is, and I'm going to pass around a little blurb on this, to show you a little bit of difference between normal bone density, that's on this side, and what happens in osteoporosis. You don't lose your bones. Obviously, you've got your bones, but the bones lose their density. And the reason for this is, again, not completely understood. The other side of this shows different food products and how much calcium is in them. Take a look at that. Bones are not a static part of our body. They're not like the wood frame of a house. Bones are constantly changing, and our body is constantly reabsorbing calcium from our bone and then putting it back in and sort of rebuilding our bone. That process goes on our whole life. And after menopause, when we no longer have estrogen in our system, we seem to lose a lot more of the calcium than we put back into our bones. And the idea, a lot of women have heard about taking calcium supplements. The problem with taking calcium supplements after menopause is without estrogen, it's difficult for our body to use that calcium, to put it back into our bone. And so the studies on osteoporosis, which have been available for quite some time, so this is one definite benefit that we've known for quite a long time, is that estrogen will prevent osteoporosis. Most women will lose about 50% of their bone mass within the first 7 years after menopause. After that, bone loss slows down.
Did you say 50%
of their bone mass. Now, the women who are at greatest risk for this are almost everybody in this room, with the exception of Margaret. White women have a much higher rate of osteoporosis. Black women, women of African descent, have much greater bone density. It's one of their great genetic benefits. All of the rest of us, unfortunately, have bad genes for this, and we are losing bone. We never had that much to begin with, and we're going to lose it. The other risk factors involved are family history. If you don't have a family history of osteoporosis, you are not as at much risk. We know that 75% of all women with osteoporosis have a strong family history for it. Small-boned people are at more risk. If you had had a lifelong diet low in calcium, you're at more risk. If you have been relatively sedentary, haven't been doing much exercise, and this is lifelong, you have a higher risk. Because The more stress you put on your bones with weight-bearing exercise, the more you stimulate your bones to make denser bone. So if you've never done much exercise or heavy work, there's not been that kind of stress to stimulate the growth of heavy bone. Also, people who have used a large amount of alcohol interferes with bone's ability to take up calcium, and by large amount I mean more than 2 drinks a day will be enough to affect your calcium. And also smoking, early menopause, obviously the longer you're without estrogen, the more problems you're going to have with losing bone. And also a high protein diet, which puts most North Americans at risk right there, because protein interferes with the way we use calcium in our bodies as well. Yes, yes, yes.
What about becoming a believer in exercise rather than late in life? Is it always?
It's going to help, you know. And the other thing, calcium supplements are going to help. They're going to slow down this rate of bone loss. The best things, and if we as mothers or aunts or friends of younger women can do, is encourage women to increase their calcium intake in their diet. And if necessary, take calcium supplements even at a young age. Young women should be getting about 1,200 milligrams of calcium a day in their diet. And those of us after menopause, we should continue to get that amount with our hormones. If you're not taking hormones, you should be getting about 1,500 milligrams of calcium a day in the diet. But again, and the things besides calcium, you also need to be doing weight-bearing exercise, because that again helps your bone use that and continue to develop more bone. And the other thing that's important besides weight-bearing exercise and the calcium is, why do I keep forgetting my last point?
By weight-bearing exercise, what exactly do you mean?
That means anything in which your body is bearing your weight.
Walking,
in other words,
running. Walking,
running, skiing, biking to some extent, though that's not probably as good as walking or running. Swimming is not weight-bearing exercise. You are not bearing your weight. Yep.
Yeah.
I know. It's good for a lot of other reasons, but it's not good for weight-bearing exercise.
Two quick examples. My mother was put on estrogen replacement therapy around age 75 after about a year and a half of severe PMS and beginning to menstruate at that age. She said, forget it.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
I don't want to deal with it.
Yeah.
But she's gotten help.
Mm-hmm.
Right before I left here, a couple days, a good friend called me and was just distraught because she's going through periods of real anxiety, won't even go out of the house alone without her husband for the few days of whatever estrogen she's on. You know, they do certain ones for so long and so on. It's driving her really crazy. What can you do when it's affecting your, you know, psychological health?
Mm-hmm.
The
way that she's on the hormones right now is affecting her psychological
yeah.
health.
Yeah.
I would suggest that she go back and see her practitioner, doctor, nurse practitioner, whatever, and see if they can adjust her dose in some way.
She called and his answer was, well, you're not alone. So,
find another doctor. Someone who's willing to experiment.
Okay.
A little bit with, you know, how they give the drugs. Someone who's maybe more comfortable giving them. You know, certain physicians just aren't very comfortable with it.
Maybe she needs to go to a women's clinic.
Yeah, yeah. Go ahead, Esther.
I would really encourage everyone here to have estrogen, because my doctor did not give it to me.
Mm-hmm.
And he retired and I've gone to another doctor. And the first thing he asked me was, have you been taking estrogen? And I said, no.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, I'm thinking of putting you on it. And then I have back problems.
Mm-hmm.
I've got some osteoporosis.
Mm-hmm.
I've got spurs. I've got my neck bone and all in. And just before I came here, I went to an orthopedic doctor. And first thing he said, have you been on estrogen? And he said, I think you better get on it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I would encourage, if I had done it 15 years ago, my doctor just never prescribed it.
Mm-hmm. And I'm going to talk a little bit about why that may have happened, and I think tomorrow night, Thursday night, we can maybe discuss it a little bit more about some of the controversies about estrogen.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's certainly not, I don't think it's for everybody, and I think it's important to look at some of the reasons for and against using
mm-hmm.
it.
Isn't there a chance of cancer?
Right, exactly, and that's what I want to get into.
Yeah. Because I know I'm on it, but then that's because I had surgery when I was very young.
Mm-hmm.
That still did not prevent me from going through all the changes. Now.
Right, exactly.
But that's why I can be on it very safely, because he said the uterus is gone and
right.
there's a chance of cancer.
Right.
Gone.
Right.
And I know it's a lifesaver from all these symptoms.
Right.
But can they prescribe it so that you're not menstruating again? Because it's so wonderful to be free of that and you start that all over again.
Yeah, there is. But maybe I could just talk about just about what it is and what they are for people who don't know. And we can get into some of those other things later or else on Thursday because we're just about out of time. In fact, we may have to continue this all on Thursday. And I knew that was the danger when we started because there's so much material, it's hard to get through all of this. But basically what doctors have been doing then, and this started in the 30s, they started prescribing estrogen as a replacement for after women had surgical menopause after they had their ovaries removed. And that stopped, that practice stopped in the mid-70s, largely because of reports that there was an increased risk of endometrial cancer. This lining of the uterus would become cancerous. The reason, and if you think back to what I described about what happens, if you keep giving someone estrogen, what you do is you keep building lining and lining and lining and lining and lining and lining and lining in your uterus. And it never has a chance to leave unless there's so much of it there that you start bleeding. What can happen if you get a thicker lining there that never leaves is that there can be some cellular changes that take place. And that does put women at higher risk for developing a cancer of the uterus. Now, a couple things about cancer of the uterus. One, it did increase 2 to 4 times. We saw it 2 to 4 times more commonly in women who took estrogen alone than women who were not taking estrogen replacement therapy. But the other thing about, in terms of cancers and serious cancers, one, frequently women have abnormal, irregular, severe bleeding, which is an early sign of that cancer. It's generally a cancer that is very much limited to that organ. Not often that uterine cancers then metastasize to other parts of the body. So again, hysterectomy is not in any way, shape, or form a minor operation. But when we think about cancers, this is a relatively easy to treat cancer in terms of what it does. So, but the perspective at the time when they realized that it was increasing the number of uterine cancers was a lot of physicians were completely terrified from that point on of ever prescribing estrogen. So a lot of you may have been to physicians who came out of that time period, were very, very fearful of estrogen and were very fearful of prescribing it because they knew that it did increase the risk of cancer.
And also came a time when we became a much more
litigious society, exactly. Society.
So doctors were
much more concerned about it. What we've learned in the last, say, 10 years is that by adding progesterone, the other hormone that we talked about, to the cycle, the way that women take estrogen, as long as they still have their uterus, what we do is we build up a lining, and then if you build up any lining with that estrogen stimulation, you will lose it after you stop taking the progesterone. The progesterone will, again, hold it in place for the period of time you're taking it. At the end of taking the progesterone, you will have a period. Well, obviously a lot of women who have gone through menopause are not very interested in having periods again. So that's one of the big reasons a lot of women don't want to take hormone replacement therapy. They simply don't want to have to go through periods again. But we know that without taking progesterone, women are at greater risk for endometrial cancer. And so most physicians, both because we know these statistics and because we know there are lawsuits out there, are going to request that you take progesterone because they don't want you to get cancer and they don't want to get sick.
So if they say 2 to 4 times as frequently, what was the rate to begin with? 1,000 women, how many people got?
You know, I'd be bad with statistics. Let me see if I can look it up here quickly. Well, the relative risk went from 1 in 1,000 to 4 in 1,000. So again, it wasn't even that pronounced. I mean, certainly it was pronounced. And it depends on how you look at it.
That's 250 women, I guess. Mm-hmm.
That's a lot.
That's a lot.
That's a lot, exactly. So, go ahead.
Now, I think you started going faster.
I'll slow down. I'd love to slow down, except it's almost time for us to leave.
Anyway, I take estrogen and progesterone all the time.
Right. And there's two different ways to give it. One way is where we try to follow sort of a normal cycle, where we give women estrogen for days 1 through 25 of their menstrual period, and then we add progesterone for the last 10 days of that. And then at the time that you stop the progesterone, you'll have a period. The other way to give it is to give both of the medications every single day of the month, and then you won't have a period.
Yay.
The problem with that is we don't like to do that with women when they're just first menopausal. The reason for that is because we know that irregular bleeding can be a sign of endometrial cancer.
You don't have that symptom. You've masked that symptom.
Well, right, not necessarily, because actually people can have more irregular bleeding on that regime where you take them both at the same time. For some reason, women tend to have more irregular bleeding. What that leads doctors to believe right away is, oh, this is possibly a sign of cancer. We need to do a biopsy of your uterus. So it can put people in a position where they're going to have more medical procedures done to them. What we like to do is wait until women are, say, 5 or 6 years away from menopause. What happens is the cells of the uterus, the cells of the endometrium, eventually sort of atrophy. They stop responding to that estrogen. But it takes 5 or 6 years.
By then they've already lost all the bones and decalcified.
Well, no, it's you would take it that way that I talked about, the cyclical way. In other words, the way that you would make you have periods. So that's what we start people on, but you're right, if we waited that long.
Right after menopause.
Right after menopause.
We keep right on with the cyclical.
Right, we put people on the cyclical hormones, and then they have a period.
Yeah.
Okay, but what we want to do is, eventually those periods get lighter and lighter and lighter as the wall of the uterus atrophies or no longer responds to that estrogen. So eventually, even if we give you estrogen, give you progesterone, you're probably not going to have very much of a bleed. At that point, about 5 or 6 years out from menopause, is when we start thinking that it's probably okay to give people both of those hormones at the same time. Those physicians that do that earlier, and I've done it earlier when I first started in practice, but I ended up sending a lot of women in to have endometrial biopsies because they had a lot of bleeding if I gave them both of those hormones all the time. You know, but that's what they preferred. They didn't want to have periods, and so I said, well, the book says we can do this, you know, when I was first in practice. But the reality is I soon learned that a lot of people had a lot of problems with bleeding.
So how do they take it in the cyclical and normal?
The cyclical fashion, there are a couple of different regimes. The one is to take estrogen days 1 through 25 of every month, and then from day 16 to 25 to add progesterone to that. Then what that means is that on day 25, between day 25 and the end of the month, you'll have a period. For most people, you take nothing then. And for most people during that period of time, those periods are lighter than what they had before. They don't have as many PMS-y symptoms. Sometimes people have more. You know, I mean, your friend talking about the kind of problems she has. And, you know, what I have to say about any medication that we give people, we have statistical information about how people are going to respond to those drugs. But that means we look at thousands of people and generally see how this percentage of people respond. But the reality is every time we give you a drug, we're doing a medical experiment. We do not know how you're going to respond to that drug, how your system is going to respond to that drug. And so you have to be with someone who's going to be willing to work with you. You know, and if you're having problems with that drug, you know, change the way it's given. There are also multiple different chemical forms.